meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come back to order. We have three bills, and we're going to try and do them as quickly as we can. Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1516, and I see you have an A2 amendment. Is that, I understand, the only amendment?
It's a good amendment, Mr. Chair. I think that is both the technical and the home and governmental unit discussion that's been going on to get this thing in the shape of collaboration.
Senator Hoffman moves the A2 amendment to put the bill in the shape he wants. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Go ahead and explain the bill with the amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1516. This is a proposal that provides rebates for natural gas vehicles and fueling stations. With me at the table today, I have John Williams from CenterPoint Energy, and I have John Hunter from the American Lung Association. So you have the Triple J up here, Mr. Chair. Troy Sandvig from CNG Innovations and Tony Kellen from Wendell are also here, but only to answer questions because I know we want to get out of here before 10 o'clock tonight. So Senate File 1516 is a product of a broad-based coalition of stakeholders that have been working over the past several months to put forth a proposal that reflects what has been successful in incentivizing compressed natural gas infrastructure and conversions across the country. And the question comes up about infrastructure and conversions. The answer is simple, Mr. Chair. It's the classic chicken and egg problem. We need infrastructure to fuel vehicles, and that encourages more vehicles to be purchased or converted. The specifics of the bill are this. It provides $3 million in rebates to incentivize the conversion of light-duty, medium-duty, and heavy-duty motor vehicles to compressed natural gas at the following levels. Light-duty is no more than 50% of the cost, not to exceed $5,000. Medium-duty is no more than 50% of the cost, and it's not to exceed $8,000. And heavy-duty, no more than 50% of the cost, not to exceed $20,000. Second thing is this bill also incentivized the construction and installation of the commercial natural gas fueling stations in the rebates for the following levels. Commercial fueling stations at 50% of the cost, not to exceed $200,000. Vehicles converted to natural gas, as we know, have far less emissions and particulate matter than conventional fuels. This bill directs the Department of Commerce in consultation with the nonprofit entity and grant administration to administer the program. It's been successful, and we feel, Mr. Chair, that we can replicate it for natural gas vehicles. One thing is this past summer, Mr. Chair, do you remember the 60 hours of energy policy that you suggested I take through the University of Idaho? Well, one of the things besides drinking water from a fire hose on the policy side was the ability to check out some of the compressed natural gas vehicles that are out there. And I got to drive an unmarked Impala police car, and that thing, I stayed within the speed limit, but you couldn't. It's amazing how the less particulate matters up in the air. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn this over to our testifiers, and John Williams and John Hunter. So thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Whichever one of you wishes to go first, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm John Williams, and I'm the manager of energy sales at CenterPoint Energy. Mr. Chair and Senators, we appreciate you hearing our bill, and thank you for the opportunity for me to testify here before you today. We appreciate Senator Hoffman authoring this bill, and also Senators Dibble, Hodge, and Ingebrigtsen co-authoring it. Our bill was prepared and is supported by a coalition of companies, and some of these are CenterPoint Energy, CNG Innovations of Minnesota, QuickTrip, McNeilus Companies, Integris, Merck, Trillium, who are all under the same umbrella, and Wendell Companies, Xcel Energy, and Zero Res. In addition to that, over the last couple of years, there was another 30 or 40 companies that have been involved in a larger supporting group that was sponsored by, on an NGV coalition that was sponsored by the American Lung Association in Minnesota via a DOE grant that they received. Our focus on this bill, based on the time we had and other factors, was to keep it as simple and straightforward as possible. So as a result, as you heard Senator Hoffman say, this is focused on natural gas. If you go to the second slide, What I want to give on this slide is just real quickly kind of go through what I call the state of the state for NGV vehicles and refueling stations in Minnesota. There are currently an estimated about 300 to 400 CNG vehicles in Minnesota, and there's 13 public fueling stations. And I'll go that into that a little more detail in the next slide. It'll show the actual locations of it. But really what we need as far as fueling stations is we need a higher concentration in the highly populated areas, or you could call it hubs, or along the major corridors. And another good example is in states where CNG is more active than it is right now in Minnesota, you'll also see it at the airport and near downtowns. There's also 12 private, what they call slow fill stations. And just in case people aren't aware, a slow fill station would be something like a refuse company that would fill overnight. So they bring the trucks back at like 5 p.m. And then by 5 a.m. when the drivers come back, and they can jump in the truck and go about their day. And fast fill would be like a normal gas station or a diesel fueling station. So it'll be at like 8 to 10 gallons per minute. An example of some other companies that are using CNG vehicles in Minnesota: Quick Trip, Dart, Bay & Bay, Senex Harvest States, or CHS, Anderson Windows. So if you go to the slide number 3, shows the current public refueling stations. And I'm going to start from the north and then just work south. But there's a station that Holiday owns in Duluth. There's St. Cloud Metro Bus along Highway 10 in St. Cloud. And that's going to open as public this spring yet. Then there's Quick Trip in St. Michael, Waste Management in Blaine. We have a station in Minneapolis there by Crosstown and 35W. And then Quick Trip also has stations in Eagan, Mankato, Owatonna, Rochester, Minnesota City, which is kind of like, it's like a suburb of Winona, if there is such a thing. And then also they have one in Austin. And then in Fairmount, CHS has a station there. Now, on this graphic, you'll see that there's one listed in Albert Lea. This graphic has since changed. That station wasn't built. It was planned at the time, and that's why it was on this graphic. So even at this scale, even though the scale of the map is small and it appears that there's a pretty good density of stations here, there really isn't sufficient density. So moving on to slide 4. So what are some of the reasons for an NGV and fueling station rebate program? Well, one of the things is natural gas is domestic, it's economical, clean, abundant, reliable, and safe. In addition, natural gas also offers price stability and less volatility than some other vehicle fuels do. Natural gas can help meet the environmental emissions initiatives, so that there's less greenhouse gases associated with it, and also less particulate matter, like Senator Hoffman mentioned, and John Hunter will get into that more. And then because the NGVs are currently incrementally more expensive, just because there isn't that many of them yet, what these rebates can do, this rebate program, is it'll help buy down the incremental cost. Commercial fleets are locating their natural gas-powered vehicles in states where there are incentives. That is a major, I've talked with several companies, and that is a major consideration in their decision. And what rebates can do is they can help jumpstart and kind of get people that are on the fence or on the sidelines, get them to jump in and convert to natural gas. So the next 3 slides, I just want to give you some ideas. I mean, there's some examples of what a light duty, what a medium duty, what a heavy duty vehicle is. So on slide 5, you see light duty, which basically consists of class 1, 2, and 3. A class 1 vehicle would be like basically a passenger car. Example would be a Honda Civic or a Chevrolet Impala. And basically, they're divided by gross vehicle weight ratings. So for the light duty, it goes up to 14,000 pounds. If you go to the medium duty slide, that's classes 4, 5, and 6. And the gross vehicle weight rating is 14,001 to 26,000 pounds. And examples there, you can see that the vehicles that we're showing here kind of tend to be utility vehicles, service vehicles, construction-type vehicles. For class 4, if you look to class 5, you're going to get some of the step vans. In class 6, you're going to get into some beverage delivery, package delivery, and school buses. If you move on to the next slide, slide number 7, heavy duty. And heavy duty is made up of class 7 and class 8. And that is for vehicles that are in excess of 26,000 pounds. And if you look at the right side, the right two pictures there, the refuse truck and the transit bus, those are Class 7. If you look at the left side, the semi and the cement truck, those are Class 8. And the commercial fleets overall, and heavy-duty vehicles in particular, are really the sweet spot when you're looking at the NGVs. And the reason for that is they're driven a lot of miles, high miles annually, or they have a high runtime, like a refuse truck. Even though a refuse truck won't drive that many miles during the day, that thing is running 100% of the time. And then also they tend to be low miles per gallon, somewhere in the 4 to 6 miles per gallon. And this presents a great opportunity to significantly reduce the emissions of these current diesel-fueled vehicles. Now, heavy-duty vehicles are primarily dedicated CNG vehicles, so they're not bi-fuel. You've probably heard that. Bi-fuel basically means it runs on natural gas and or gasoline. And so it's an excellent utilization, and what I mean by that is they're going to run, if somebody buys a CNG heavy-duty vehicle, they're going to get a payback faster because there's not going to be any split between the natural gas and the gasoline. Moving on to the next slide. So the vehicle rebates, and the only thing I'm going to point out here, because Senator Hoffman did a really good job of covering the points, what I'm going to try to give you a feel for is I just showed you pictures on all three of the slides of the different vehicle types. So with light duty, all I want to present on these different vehicle types is light duty, the incremental cost is about $9,000 to $12,000. For medium duty, the incremental cost is about $15,000 to $30,000. And for heavy duty, the incremental cost is about $40,000 to $70,000. Moving on, the fueling station rebates. So you just saw the vehicle rebate portion of the program. For the fueling station rebates, for privately owned or retail fueling stations, like as Senator Hoffman mentioned, we have a $200,000 cap per station. And I'll talk about impact in the next slide. And so home fueling's out, so now we won't talk about that. So on the vehicle program, there was $3 million appropriate or allocated for that. For the fueling station rebates, there's $2 million allocated for that. And station costs can vary, and if any of the members have questions on that, Tony Kellen has a lot of experience on that, and he can answer those questions. But what I will say is that they vary a lot depending on whether a station is a fast fill, whether it's a slow fill. So fast fill stations will be more expensive because of the storage that is required. And the number of vehicles that are required to be filled at one time, that's also going to affect costs. And there are some other perspectives or dynamics. So if you look at slide number 10, the projected rebate program impact. So obviously my slide says $6 million, but now with the amendment, it would be $5 million. We project an increase in vehicles of about 330. So that would be an increase of approximately 80 to 100%. The projected increase in private and retail stations is 10, and that's an increase if you add the private and the public, so that's 25. That's about a 40% increase, which is very good. And we've also built in some limitations, which we thought, you know, obviously with the money here, we wanted several businesses and whoever to have access to this. So some of the limitations we built in is no more than one vehicle rebate per resident household for a passenger car or light-duty vehicle, no more than $50,000 for light-duty and medium-duty vehicles per business entity per year, no more than $100,000 for heavy-duty vehicles per business entity per year, and then no more than one fueling station rebate per business entity per year. So in conclusion, the bill and its rebate program is needed to jumpstart the CNG market and receive the benefits of doing so, such as reduced emissions. And then also the rebates have worked in other states. Some of the other states that have done this and done this successfully is Colorado, Indiana, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, et cetera. And like I said, that's just a few. Down the road, the rebates won't be needed, but they do need a jump start. So we respectfully ask that you support our bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Hunter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chairman Martins, members, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is John Hunter. I'm with the American Lung Association, Minnesota's Clean Vehicles and Technology Program. There is a packet of approximately 8 slides or so. And, I think in your packets, I tend to skip through those pretty quickly, but I really just kind of want to touch on air quality in Minnesota, the role that tailpipes have in our air quality, and how clean fuels like natural gas can help that situation out. Minnesota's air is not as healthy as it needs to be. There's a chart on page 3 of your document that highlights sort of our ozone levels currently in Minnesota. Ozone is formed on warm summer days when tailpipe emissions and other pollutants kind of get together and form into ozone. And exposure to ozone has been likened to getting a sunburn on your lungs. It can cause inflammation and exacerbation of asthma or other respiratory issues, and can result in hospitalizations or emergency room visits. Currently, the U.S. EPA is in the process of reviewing what level our ozone should be set to under the Clean Air Act. It's part of the 5-year review they go through. Last December, they proposed setting the level between 65 and 70 parts per billion. As you can see on the chart, currently a number of places within Minnesota are in the 60 to 68 parts per billion range. So where they set that level would be very particular, would have potential strong impacts throughout Minnesota. The Science Advisory Committee for the EPA actually proposed a setting somewhere between the range of 60 and 70 parts per billion. So the American Lung Association actually believes that the level should be set to 60. And the EPA was open to comments on that period, but again, they are sort of proposing that 65 to 70 range. They will set a final rule on October 1st of this year, so we will have to kind of wait to see what happens then. But as it currently stands, if our air quality does not improve quickly, we would be ruled in non-attainment under the Clean Air Act, which not only demonstrates, I guess, health impacts, but could have severe economic impacts as well. It's been estimated that it would cost approximately $200 million a year or so to get back into attainment if we go out. So they're both health consequences and economic ones. The next page kind of demonstrates that the fine particulate matter is in a similar situation. We're a couple years out still of the 5-year review for fine particulates, 2.5. But the levels in Minnesota do currently exceed what the Science Advisory Committee for the EPA has recommended that the levels start to go down to. So fine particulates can have similar health impacts as ozone. They actually can travel, the very small ones can travel deep into the lungs, actually pass through the lung linings and into the bloodstream, so they can cause cardiovascular issues as well as lung issues. Particulate matter is also associated with cancer and premature death. So all of that kind of put together has led the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to estimate that air quality impacts in Minnesota have approximately a $34 billion annual cost. Not necessarily a direct cost. A lot of that has to do with people dying prematurely. But even once you start to take into account missed days from work because a kid needs to be taken to a hospital for an asthma attack and things like that, there tend to be severe economic prices that we are currently paying that will get worse if our air does not continue to get better. As the pie chart on page 5 kind of demonstrates, the largest source of our air pollution issues in Minnesota are tailpipes. That's true with the on-road vehicles, but when you combine the on-road and the off-road vehicles together, you're approximately almost half of air emissions in Minnesota for either on a direct or indirect basis for what forms the particulate and ozone issues that we have. And this is really kind of where alternative fuel vehicles kind of come into play to help us reduce these emissions. As mentioned on the next page there, alternative fuel vehicles, natural gas vehicles in particular, can significantly reduce the ozone formers, the particulate formers, and even greenhouse gas emissions. I will also mention right now as well, since the next bill on the docket is on electric vehicles, that they also have strong roles to play in reducing tailpipe emissions in a very similar fashion of helping improve our air quality. One last bit that the funding proposed in this bill, as mentioned on slide 7, is modeled after an E85 program that we worked with on the Department of Commerce, where funding was allocated to the Department of Commerce, and we helped administrate the funding We did a lot of the logistics, and the department staff approved each station before any kind of finalization, so they provided oversight, but we did some of the groundwork. And that is all just to say that with that program, with other programs, we have worked on a lot of E85 infrastructure programs and seen how the type of grant program proposed in Senator Hoffman's bill can really result in getting alternative fuels much more widespread in use. And so with that, I will just wrap up to say, I guess we need to reduce our vehicle emissions, and this is one great way to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Questions from the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the number of vehicles right now, that this probably is not a large issue, but looking down the road, if there is an increase in the number of vehicles, how do you envision fueling vehicles this way will contribute to in terms of road and bridge repair, and what are you expecting as far as these vehicles to contribute to the wear and tear they're going to put on the roads if they're not buying fuel products that are encumbered with a fuel tax?
Senator, my understanding is that I know there was a bill offered by somebody else earlier to equal the taxes that are paid by natural gas to equal diesel and gasoline. So my understanding, I think that was moving forward, my understanding that they would be equal taxes, so they would be paying their fair share. One of the things that they were trying to work out is LNG to make sure that they weren't paying more, because there's a 1.6 gallons or 1.7 gallons of LNG equals a diesel gallon equivalent. So if you did it just on a gallon basis, they'd be paying too much. So it just equalizes. So okay. I think we are paying our fair share is my answer.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just had a question related to the CNG-fueled vehicles emit considerably less of the following major air pollutants. Can you tell me how much less they emit than gasoline, and then how much less they emit from diesel? And maybe you covered that and I missed it, but.
Chairman Marty, Senator Scalzi, I did not put in particular numbers for a bit of a reason, in that it really depends on which engine you're kind of comparing to which other engine, and if the size of the engine and the size of the vehicle all have kind of different rates. It's generally safe to say that every sort of vehicle you would replace a gasoline or a diesel engine with natural gas would see a reduction in a number of pollutants, but the exact amount of that reduction would differ based off the size of the engine.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you. But just generally speaking, would it be like a quarter less or half less? Just say for light trucks.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just kind of trying to get a ballpark.
Chairman Martin, Senator Scalzi, the one number I've seen specifically kind of mentioned, I think came from the Natural Gas Vehicle Association, where they compared a Honda Civic that you can get in a natural gas version or a gasoline version. And it was there were some that were up to 80% of a reduction. I don't know that they're always that large. And, you know, if you happen to be replacing or repowering an older diesel engine with a much newer natural gas technology, that's also going to have a much larger leap. But it can be quite large. And I think greenhouse gas-wise tends to be in the 20 to 30% range.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi. Yeah, the information that I have is for heavy-duty vehicles, there's about a 20 to 23% reduction. For light-duty, it's a little more, about 26 to 29% reduction.
Did you say what chemicals, what pollutants?
This is for just greenhouse gases overall. So, I mean, it would be the NOx and...
Yeah, what about particulates? I assume that's huge with diesel, but...
Yeah,
Maybe you could get information for folks. I think there's a lot of interest in knowing what that would be.
Yes.
Okay, Senator Rosen, Senator Hoffman, did you have something you were trying to...
No, Mr. Chair, that's a great conversation. You know, ACE, not ACE the hardware people, but ACE the garbage haulers up in Ramsey, in Anoka Ramsey area, they all their trucks, and they come down my drive down my road, they're all compressed natural gas, and it's doesn't stink on Friday mornings in my neighborhood. So,
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Hoffman.
Yeah. Senator Rosen, he didn't say whether his neighborhood stinks other
than. Yeah, I don't know how to follow that one.
What was your question, Senator Rosen?
Great question. or Mr. Williams, is there a federal match to this or a rebate coming from the feds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, no, there isn't at this point in time. This would come out of the general fund.
Is there, Mr. Chair, is there any other alternative fuel that anybody knows of that does have a federal match?
Chairman Marty, Senator Rosen, the only kind of tangentially thing I can think of, and it depends on, Congress, how far out they do their tax bills, but there have been some infrastructure development programs that have allowed like a 30% tax credit on the cost of installing the refueling side of infrastructure for certain alternative fuels, fairly broadly. So that includes anything from an electric vehicle recharging station to E85 pumps, things like that. I believe that it was done retroactively for last year, but is not currently in place for this year. They did it late December to apply to all of last year, but currently I do not think it exists.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason I ask is I was just reading this article about propane, which I would assume, Mr. Hunter, that you would consider that also an alternative fuel in the mix of all this also. But it talks about that the police cars in Wisconsin that are actually made in Mankato, some of the technology, gets a 50-cent rebate from the federal government for each gallon of propane they use. So that just got me thinking if there's other rebates out there for alternative fuels or sometimes other incentives that we haven't thought about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, over time, kind of like what John was talking about, the federal government has had some rebates, and they did have a fuel tax rebate. It would apply to propane, it would apply to natural gas. They don't currently have that. There was some rebates that they put into effect last year, like in the middle of the year, and then it went retroactive to the beginning of the year, but it ended at the end of 2014. I can't remember for sure if the fuel tax credit was part of it. I think it was. I guess the other thing to note is from time to time, there is grants available through the Department of Energy. So, those are available from time to time. And I know the American Lung Association is very aware of that and work on those.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along those lines, and along propane has been brought up, we recognize that there's been actually propane being used for a number of years in terms of vehicles. And so how do your numbers stack up when you start to compare your emissions and things as far as usage of propane versus the compressed natural gas?
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, I guess a couple of things that just come to mind. I know from the standpoint of, like, natural gas, the molecule is CH4, so there's one carbon atom. Now, propane, I think, is C3-6, I think. They're relatively close. That's the one comparison I know off the top of my head.
Senator,
Mr. Chair, so thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who can answer this. Do you have to have a separate station for propane? You'd have to have a separate, completely different system for propane that can be also dual fuel, though, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, that is correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Further discussion, if not, Senator Huffman.
Senator Marty and members, thank you for the conversation today regarding compressed natural gas, and I'd like to move Senate File 1516 to be passed and sent to Finance.
Finance, I'm sorry. On that motion, is there further discussion? Senator...
As amended, Mr.
Knopf.
Chair.
Mr. Knopf has a technical amendment as well.
Mr. Chair, just to make everything consistent with the earlier amendment where governmental units or businesses will be the only ones eligible for the fueling station. I think it would be clear on 2.9 after residents insert comma governmental units comma just to make it clear. I mean, and then I think after including insert but not limited to, because one of my concerns is when I looked at the list on 2.10 it says cities and I don't see towns in there, and there may be other ones that aren't aren't included. In fact, cities, when you use the term city, it doesn't include home rule charters unless it's specifically in. So I was thinking that delete cities and insert municipalities, so you'd pick up all towns, cities, whether they're home rule or not. So I think that would make it clear who's eligible for the rebate. And then, Mr. Chair, on, that's on page 2. Those are lines 2.9 and 2.10. And then on page 3, line 3, after entity, insert or governmental unit. And then on page 3, line 5, insert after entity, insert or governmental unit. And then I think on 3.6, you need to delete home and insert governmental unit, because they're to be the only ones that will get the rebate for the fueling station. And I think that would make it clear with the earlier amendment that residents, governmental units, and businesses are eligible for the rebate for the vehicle itself, but only governmental units or business entities are eligible for the rebate for the fueling station. I think that cleans. I can go back through that. I just wanted to.
So Senator Hoffman moves that, and that's page 2.10. Delete cities and certain municipalities?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, let me read the entire amendment as I was kind of trying to describe it as I was going, but on 2.9, after residents, insert comma governmental units comma. On 2.10, delete cities and insert municipalities. On also on 2.9, after including, I'm sorry, I missed that one. On 2.9, after including, insert comma but not limited to comma, in case there's somebody we haven't forgot to include there. And so that would be the changes on 2.9 and 2.10. So it would read Minnesota residents, governmental units, and business entities, including but not limited to state agencies, transit authorities, school districts, municipalities, or counties that purchase a. And then, okay. Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 3, after entity, insert or governmental unit. Page 3, line 5, after entity, again, insert or governmental unit. And then page 3, line 6, delete home and insert governmental unit.
Senator Hoffman moves that. Is there any discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question for Mr. Williams, actually. And actually, you mentioned Mr. Williams, and on the map, there is a refueling station in my district in Fairmont.
Correct.
And are they eligible then for the rebate? I'm not even sure if it's open. There was problems with it getting opened, and I'm not certain if it's open yet. But any of these stations that are already in place, are they eligible for the rebate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, my understanding is they would not be, because I think the effective date was like October 1st of this year is what we had talked about in the bill. So, I mean, as the bill currently sits, my understanding is they would not be.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, this bill appropriates money, so if it passed on its own, which not likely would, it'd be part of an omnibus bill, but it would likely be July 1st for the effective date, so it would apply to purchases after that date, so purchases after. Generally, you have to purchase it after the law takes effect, unless we put a retroactive effective date.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
There are some winners and losers in this bill in different aspects.
How do you
definitely, but for somebody that has already invested in a refueling station for other alternative fuels, there are some winners and losers.
Senator Rosen, yeah, that's the nature of it. Of course, the purpose of it is to encourage more to do it, but yes, that's true.
Yeah.
If any of these, whenever we provide an incentive for those who purchased earlier. Anyway, Senator Hoffman renews his motion that Senate File 1516 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion of that motion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you.
Chairman, Senate Council has not come back with the amendment to Senate File 1948 yet, and I apologize for that.
So, Senator Marty, then, do you want to jump ahead to Senate File 674?
Sure, let's do that one first, then.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
And, Mr. Chair, this is a bill, a subject we dealt with a couple of several weeks ago in another bill, which was sent to Commerce, it went to Health and Human Services after here and then to Commerce, or didn't go to Health and Human Services, went to Commerce, and then the staff of that committee point out, because it was, this is a technical companion to the other bill, they passed this one out and sent it back to us. This is the subject of microbeads, and since, thank you, and I have the A1 amendment. This is I'm not going to offer it as an author's amendment, but this is language that we had passed here with, I think, two exceptions that were made in discussions with the industry, one of which was to take the effective dates on when these take effect, take the language that they had preferred, which our bill was 2016 for everything, I believe, December 2016. And instead, we have you can't manufacture personal care products after the end of 2017. You can't sell them after end of 2018. And over-the-counter drugs that contain microbeads, which I believe is limited to toothpaste, would be extended 1 year beyond those two dates. We also took out a penalty provision that we had in the bill that we passed out of this committee. And I believe this language would be the same as we pass out here, other than those two changes, the one about the penalties and the timeline, which was slowed down by 1 to 3 years as requested in the discussions with the industry. And, Mr. Chair,
Senator Marty,
the difference from the other bill, from the bill that you were carrying and that Commerce took up because it had companion bill, that bill had a different definition. They excluded certain in the definition of synthetic plastic microbead. They defined one as not all synthetic plastic microbeads, but only those that were used for certain purposes or for non-biodegradable. Instead, in this one, it uses the language we had in the bill we passed over this committee, which is that if they believe the microbeads are biodegradable and would degrade quickly in the natural environment, they can petition the commissioner for an exception. So notice the definition is a plastic microbead is a plastic microbead, but if they do make biodegradable ones, they can seek an exception. And with that, I'm going to move the A1 amendment and glad to stand for questions.
Any questions from members on the A1 amendment? Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, you took out the penalty provision, so what happens if somebody does sell or manufacture?
Sure.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, if somebody was violating the law, it's I believe the law, when we don't specify in law, it's a petty misdemeanor. But bottom line, the way agency would enforce it would be through getting court ordered to get them to stop selling it. So in other words, the industry was concerned about somebody going in there and getting a criminal penalty or a large fine for doing it. We took that out. All it is that they could be ordered to stop doing it, basically. And it's petty misdemeanor, which I think is $250 maximum fine if they chose to prosecute, if you prosecute a petty misdemeanor. But it's the standard for when we make something illegal. I think the realistic result would be they'd order them to stop selling it or whatever.
Senator Scalzi, follow up or no? Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marty, do we know what stakeholders think of making this amendment to Senator Hoffman's bill?
Sure. Mr. Chair, we can have, if you want testimony, we can have testimony. I'm sure there are plenty of people who would be happy to talk to it. They said they didn't like that definition. Last time I spent a number of meetings negotiating with them, and I told them I'd take all their concerns, except I think the definition of a microbead should be a microbead, and if they think they're non, if they think they are biodegradable, they should show it. But that's basically it. If you want to have their testimony, I see plenty of them in the room who, at least I saw some in the room who'd be, I'm sure, willing to testify.
Senator Marty is inviting those that want to come up and testify. Anybody want to approach the bench or the table or the chair? What do we call it, Senator Weber?
The couch.
The couch? The
couch? As long as it's not the jury box. Mr. Chairman, Tony Quillis from Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. You are correct, Senator Marty. The differences, has pointed out the differences in what was introduced in your bill and into his bill. We did have a number of constructive meetings with him. The bills, basically, as he's pointed out, contain the, from the chamber's perspective, the manufacturer retail lag, the timeline that's set up that the industries can make. The question that the chamber is worried about is the consistency, Mr. Chairman. As you've heard in previous testimony, no. The NCSL has a model law that's been being adopted, I think, in over 20 states that it's being debated right now. Illinois has definitely passed it. I think this model law has been being debated, I think, in over 20 states so far. So the consistency among the manufacturers and retailers that we represent is of concern. Senator Marty, as I said, has pointed out the differences in 1.22 and 1.23 in the definition section on the A1 amendment, that where non-biodegradable is in the original Hoffman bill, and then it, there was some language in there about exfoliating and rinse and clean off, I think, were the actual language. And then because of that, Senator Marty's replacement is to go and petition the Pollution Control Agency. We want to thank him also, as we pointed out about, we thought under the General Attorney General statute enforcement under 325, so that was Senator Scalzi's question, that we could take that out. And then the one other thing that's missing, Madam Chair, that the industry supported as well as the chamber, was there was a preemption section in your bill that's gone. So those are our thoughts, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman. I've been doing this way too much this week, so I have to keep addressing myself, whether it's senators and representatives and Mr. and Madam Chair. But Mr. Chairman, so those are our thoughts. I mean, we obviously would prefer the bill that's consistent among other states, but Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time to express our thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. So I'm hearing a couple of points. Is there, Senator Marty, did there was a clause that you had added within your conversation about it, the going to the petitioning the PCA, is that a lengthy process, or is that?
Mr. Chair, no.
Senator Marty.
This is intended. Nobody suggested a different way of doing it, but simply if a person being here, a manufacturer who's making a product that would have beads, would simply go and say, hey, look, here's the evidence that this biodegrades. And the reason I think we should be different than what Illinois has done, and I don't know if any other states have adopted yet, and I think ours would be a more appropriate one for model legislation, because in Lake Superior, and I think the members of Great Lakes Commission have pointed out very well, the water temperature is not very warm, and even tiny bits of plastic that might biodegrade in certain settings aren't going to biodegrade in the cold aquatic environment. And so I think it's more appropriate to do this. And yes, other states, I think, will, if we could become the second state to do it, I think other states will look at both of them, and I think ours is more likely to be what they'd adopt, because if they can show, if it's truly biodegradable, show it. We're not new staff. I asked the agency. They didn't see any need for new staff. There aren't that many manufacturers of this, and I think they are going to just go in and say, look, here's the evidence. It's biodegradable. That's what's intended to be, as a simple thing. They just have to show the commissioner and convince them that it does break down in our environment quickly.
So, Senator Marty, that seems to be the sticking point, you know, along all three bills, and knowing, you know, Senator Reinhart saying, you know, what's happening in the Great Lakes and breaking it down. And I wonder if the PCA can talk about the breakdown, the years of breakdown, or what's an acceptable time when it breaks down. Mr. Quillis, I didn't mean to move you away, but I just you know what, Mr. Quillis, I'm sorry. Well, it's because I saw a PCA guy getting up to walk. So maybe Senator Marty, if the PCA could help us understand that, how it relates to
what is an appropriate time of breaking down in the biodegradable? Because I'm convinced that this is the sticking point that's the difference between the, what's running in the House and what we had here in my bill and in the two that we're talking about. So,
and Mr. Chair, before the department speaks, yeah, I mean, the concern is because of the nature of plastics, lots of toxic stick to it kind of thing, and even these tiny things, which are fish do eat, and it transfers from that to their fatty tissue, and so we want it to break down very quickly. I mean, that's the whole point. If something this small is going to break down very quickly, if it's going to break down, and we want to make sure it's done quickly, so we simply say it to them.
Welcome. Please state your name and division or agency, please.
Mr. Chair, I'm Glenn Scuda, the Surface Water Monitoring Manager for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Welcome.
I would just comment that, you know, Senator Marty's bill essentially would set a performance standard or a design standard for industry to be able to show that if these bees are going to be used in a product, that if they're claiming them to be truly biodegradable, if they can demonstrate that so we know they break down completely in a short period of time in a natural environment, that there's not an environmental problem, that we'd be able to judge that then. Otherwise, with the language just saying non-biodegradable beads, we don't know what that means. We don't know how the law would be appropriately applied without a definition on the term. So I can understand the desire for industry to want consistency, but I think before consistency, we want the law to be written in such a way that it's clear to everybody how it is actually applied.
Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, I don't know what we put in the packets today, but Mr. Scuda and others were the authors of the report on plastic microbeads last December. And I think I've heard from probably every member of the Great Lakes Commission on in the Senate. I know Senator Senjum and Senator Rood and Senator Rest and Senator Reinert, and I'm not sure who else is on it from the Senate, but all four of them have expressed strong concern about what's happening there and strong support for the legislation.
There was the comment, Mr. Scuda, about the performance standards and then demonstrating the breakdown of the biodegradable on the beads. Are there some benchmarks that you're looking for that would indicate whether or not there's a toxic level within the water? Because we all want to get to the outcome, the same intended goal and outcome. But this, to me, seems to be in being part of all three bills seems to be, you know, the point of contention. And we'd like to work this through so that at the end of the day, we have a good bill with good amendments that are there. And does that make sense?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think it could be, as Senator Marty said, a simple demonstration that you know, if the manufacturer is going to claim or name a type of bead that they're going to use in their product as biodegradable, they have to have some sort of basis for naming it as such. So we would just need them to show us whether it's lab analysis, lab trials that they've done, product testing that shows, you know, in a natural environment, cold water, rapid breakdown of the beads, according to what Senator Marty has in his amendment.
Any questions for Mr. Scuda or Senator Marty on what we just discovered?
Mr. Chair, I should tell you that Senator Reinert, I don't know where he got him, but he got all these things. They were sitting in my office because he gave them to me during the Commerce Committee hearing. He brought them in there, and I forgot to, but he had pulled out three bottles of stuff, and somebody had apparently screened out and washed all the little microbeads in their little jars. They're very tiny little beads. Not everything that looks like little beads in shampoo or something are microbeads, I do know. I think it was you, Mr. Chair, who brought me a bottle of hand cleaner that had little red beads in it, and we tested they were simply oil beads or something. They were not plastic microbeads.
That's great, Senator Marty. There was another person that I saw at the table, too, that wanted to We're good. So we have another testifier. Looks like John Lincheski, Trouts Unlimited. Mr. Lincheski, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lincheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited and represent stakeholders here. You know, they've done some testing in Lake Superior in the Duluth area. 18% of the fish have microbeads in their stomachs. Very concerning. Microbeads absorb the toxins that are in the system and then get absorbed into the flesh. And our ability to have a nice shore lunch goes out the window. So we're very concerned. But I just want to applaud, you know, the chair and other senators for bringing this legislation forward. I applaud the industry for recognizing that there's a serious problem here and their willingness to change practices. And I think they have the best of intentions. However, good intentions are not enough in this case. What we need is clear language in the bill to really solve this problem. And Senator Marty's amendment of the definition of a synthetic plastic microbead, and I think that's I'm not sure which subpart it is. But that, you know, really removes the ambiguity in the so-called model language. It removes a nonsensical sort of exemption depending on how you're going to use the product. I mean, the fish and aquatic life don't care what your intended use was on the land. A microbead in the water is a microbead in the water. So that's kind of nonsensical. This amendment would remove that. And it would fix the problem once and for all. You know, it's key to remember there is no definition of biodegradability or non-biodegradability. There is no definition out there. There's no definition PCA can point to and say, aha, okay, I got a non-biodegradable thing. So that portion of the amendment, subdivision 3, that essentially is giving you a definition of biodegradability then. So this amendment is great because it takes away that ambiguity. Again, fish don't care, and aquatic life doesn't care what you label it. They don't care if it's labeled biodegradable or not. If it's in the water, it's in the water. So, our concern here is that if we leave the definition with this sort of ambiguity for a non-biodegradable a bead or a biodegradable bead, we're just going to substitute one problem for the next. So, we've got microbeads in the water industry. We all recognize it's a serious problem. We've got to get them out. But if we keep this sort of language in that keeps that ambiguity, we might just have a bunch of microbeads labeled by industry biodegradable, which in fact are not. They're in our cold environment, and they're still causing the problem. So we won't have fixed the problem. So, again, I think the process in Subdivision 3 makes a whole lot of sense. It's going to save taxpayers money. If we have an ambiguous definition, we're going to have industry coming and saying, well, you, state of Minnesota, do studies to show it's not biodegradable. So it makes sense that it's on the industry as they look for alternatives that they bring forth the research and show that it truly breaks down in our environment.
Thank you, Mr. There's a question from Senator Benson, Mr. Lincheski. I was just trying to. We're interested in time. We're going to try to keep moving along here. So, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if this has been covered. I was retained in Judiciary. Subdivision 3, the exemptions. The industry is supposed to prove that it can break down within 2 weeks in a natural environment. Well, the environment in Florida, being very moist and very warm in August, would break down much faster than the environment in Minnesota in January. And so who has to prove what and how is not clarified by this at all. If a company wants to sell in Minnesota, do they have to test in Minnesota? Because it doesn't say that.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I intended this to deal with that difference. So they couldn't say, well, in a warm compost bin, it might biodegrade quickly. I'm willing to insert, I think the way to do it in a natural, perhaps, and maybe I'll ask Senate Council, in the natural environment in Minnesota. Because and that's multiple places. I mean, it's basically going to be in our waterways, and obviously Lake Superior temperature may be different than a small stream, but we want it to break down in all Minnesota natural environments. It's being flushed through the waste stream. That's why I think they should have a real burden to prove it. The intent here was to be in Minnesota's natural aquatic environment, and if Senate Council feels more language, or if you feel more language would be helpful there, I certainly wanted to make the point where it goes gets flushed here, not what happens in Florida.
Senator Benson, follow up, or you want to see if council can come up with some?
I'm not really trying to solve it. I just don't think this language has been completely thought out. 2 weeks in January is completely different than 2 weeks in August. So if they test in August, is that good enough? Or is the PCA going to come back and say, oh, no, what we really meant is the 2 weeks between January 15th and January 30th is the only time you can test?
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean it to be that precise. I meant that they come in and show the commissioner. If the commissioner says, look, our water at Lake Superior never gets above whatever temperature, you got to show us that it does it there. But I think your point is that we don't want to confuse it with Florida or something. I will suggest, and maybe Senate Council can do it, something about in aquatic environment in Minnesota. But if Senate Council has better language, I'm happy to.
They're thinking, Senator Marty, so.
I think her point is well taken. If people think they meant Florida, I don't want that to be what people are taking.
But it's Senator Marty, it's the discussion on that the breakdown piece the PCA, you know, is bringing up, and it'd be nice to have some kind of parameter there, because it's a good point to bring up. Senator Marty, Mr. Knopf, what do you think?
Oh, I think Mr. Doyle.
Well, okay. Mr. Chair, members, I and we were just talking about that. I think that we probably want to include aquatic, just because most of the time when this is tested, you want it to be in water, not on the land. So would break down within 2 weeks in the natural aquatic environment in Minnesota, or in Minnesota's natural aquatic environment?
Mr. Chair, I'll take the first one of those two.
Senator Marty, thank you.
In the natural aquatic environment in Minnesota. I'll move that.
Senator Marty moves natural aquatic environment in Minnesota. Did I say that right? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Senator Marty, it moves. Now, looking at the A1 amendment, Senator Marty, any other comments before we move on the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill.
Thank you. Senator Marty moves Senate file 674 with as amended. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
We didn't. I got to move the amendment, don't I?
Yeah.
We had moved the amendment. See, I moved the A1 earlier. Didn't we?
No.
Senator Martin.
Then we do testimony.
Okay, I'll move the A1 amendment with the change incorporated that was adopted by suggested by Senate Council.
Thank you. Senator Marty's going to move the A1 amendment with the amendment that was verbally authorized. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
The amendment passes. Senator Marty.
Move the bill as amended be recommended pass.
Strategery. Senator Marty moves Senate file 674A as amended to pass. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
It passes. Thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Marty, you're still there.
Mr. Chair, we do have the A2 amendment. I don't know if it's been distributed yet for the Senate file 1948. But I would. This is the first committee for this bill, and I'd like to move that amendment.
Author's amendment on A2, Senator Marty. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, and I apologize to advocates and anybody who wants to see this, because nobody has seen the amendment till now. and I apologize for the late look at it. But this is scaling back some of the bill. The part that I had talked to people about was we're putting the natural gas provision. Senator Huffman, we just adopted a bill he had for incentive program for that. This would be one strictly limited to electric vehicles. And the House Energy Chair and I, who have been working on this, haven't had much chance to talk, but I think both he and I have
5 o'clock.
Concerns about the way it, some of the concerns about the way it was in there. Yeah. This is now simply an electric vehicle incentive plan, and I'll go through the bill, and then we have 4 or 5 witnesses on the bill.
4 or 5 witnesses, Senator Marty?
Well, you know,
Senator Weber says you can't come with a bill without having 15. So I mean, it's the
Mr. Chair, a lot of mine don't have any witnesses.
No, I'm kidding, Senator Marty. That was
testifiers. I was not supposed to use the word witness.
Testifiers. Yeah, thank you. So, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Section 1 would be requiring 2 public utilities. The language is on the second page, the third page. Electric utilities that represent cities, investor-owned utilities that cover cities of the first class in Minnesota, which would be, to be precise, Xcel and Minnesota Power, would be required to develop an electric vehicle promotion program and submit plans to the commissioner, to the Public Utilities Commission for approval. And those incentive plans were to encourage the use of electric vehicles by their customers. And the commission, what they should consider is spelled out on line 112 and so on. Definition section for electric vehicle, public utility, and so on. We're just adding electric vehicles into the definition for Chapter 216B. Then we have a new section, electric vehicle promotion program. And that section would require those 2 public utilities to form a program to promote what we talked about in Section 1, a program that would promote the purchase of electric vehicles and construction of electric vehicle infrastructure, the same sort of thing we were talking about in the natural gas bill, with education elements, rebates, for the vehicles and installing charging stations, and a pilot program for studying vehicle-to-grid technology. Because, again, one of the benefits of electric vehicles is you can charge off-peak hours, which helps the utilities with their grid stabilization. And, for that matter, as a significant number of vehicles get more powerful batteries, it may actually be something on a hot summer afternoon where people could sell power back from the batteries to the grid. So a pilot program they would consider there. The rest of that's just the commission approval of it. Section 4 is the section of the bill with the rebates, and it would allow purchasers of electric vehicles, in this version, a $3,000 rebate. I think we would, I would be interested in talking with the advocates and utilities and everyone about having the department scale back rebates as sales of these vehicles increase, but we would be allowing that rebate, and then to the extent that appropriations are exceeded by applications, it would be first come, first served basis. And I am suggesting here that the provisions would expire in 5 years. Right now they're selling about 500 electric vehicles a year. I would expect that to grow exponentially in the next few years. The House Energy Chair drives an electric car, and he talks about he's in Dakota County. He says his electric rates are such that he paid something like $17 for fuel for his first 1,000 miles. The cost of operating them is very inexpensive, and as technology is improving rapidly, and I don't want to get into all the testimony, but there's a chart in here showing the range of some of these vehicles, and only 2 of them now are exceeding 100 miles, but I think you're going to see a big change very quickly. And as that falls, I think you're going to have huge... We want to help encourage to promote this for a short period of time until it takes off on its own, and I think that's likely to happen. But I'd rather turn it over for people to testify, and I see four witnesses. It was not four or five on the list I have.
Well, all except four, Senator Marty. That's good. You want to keep these testimonies brief and to the point in fairness of where we're at. So you got Brendan Jordan come on up and Jukka Kukkonen. Brendan's from the Great Plains Institute, and Jukka is from, and I hope I said that right, Plug and Connect. Brendan, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will keep my comments brief. My name is Brendan Jordan. I am with the Great Plains Institute and representing today the Drive Electric Minnesota Partnership, which is the state's plug-in vehicle partnership, including automakers, auto dealers, electric utilities, co-ops, local governments, the environmental community, and importantly, plug-in vehicle owners. Gasoline is about an $8 billion market in Minnesota. That's up from about $4 billion annually about 10 years ago. And in order to have a $100 million impact in savings for Minnesotans, all you would need is about 1.5% of passenger vehicles to be electric. If you drive an electric plug-in vehicle, you have the opportunity to pay less than a dollar per gallon equivalent for gasoline and save considerably on oil changes and other operating costs. Drive Electric Minnesota feels that plug-in vehicles are an important component of Minnesota's more energy-efficient, cleaner transportation system.
Earlier today,
Drive Electric Minnesota does have a policy committee. We have weighed in sort of in two areas as a policy committee where we think Minnesota could really move things forward. One of those issues is creating a rebate program. If we look at what other states have done, 18 other states have rebate programs, and that has really increased the adoption of plug-in vehicles. The other issue is plug-in vehicles are a tremendous opportunity to make our electric utilities and co-ops to add efficiency for ratepayers in a whole bunch of ways throughout that system by creating load when it's needed, nighttime load when the demand is low, to absorb renewable electricity into the system and do that in a more efficient way. So our coalition has supported policy that would basically just enable and encourage that kind of innovation by electric utilities. The partnership would really like to thank Senator Marty for bringing this bill forward, and the direction, general direction, is in general lines up with what a lot of electric vehicle advocates in the state see as what should happen. You know, I would just say, as part of the coalition, we're having a lot of discussions as a coalition on exactly what the details should look like, and there probably are some details to work out with this language. But it's our position as a coalition that, you know, we would like to see this move forward so that that discussion can continue and more of those issues can be worked out in the next committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope that was brief enough.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Mr. Kukkonen.
Mr. Chair and members of committee, I'll try to be even more brief. So I'm Jukka Kukkonen from Plug and Connect, and I'm representing here EV owners as the coordinator of the Minnesota Plug-in Vehicle Owners Circle. Minnesota electric vehicle owners would like to see more people driving electric. The reality is that we need to wean ourselves off of oil as quickly as possible, and electric vehicles provide us a great way to do that. In addition to being four times more efficient than traditional cars, electric vehicles are also really fun to drive. Everyone who has shifted to driving electric says it's one of the best decisions of their life, and they are never going back. And just this year, the 3,000 Minnesota plug-in vehicle owners will drive over 20 million gas-free miles. In our family, we have driven about 26,000 miles with our electric car in the last 2 years, 2.5 years. And electric cars are kind of like LED lighting. A couple of years ago, many people were still saying that they want to stick with the old bulbs. But now when people have tried the new LEDs and learned how well the new technology works and how much it saves money, they are really starting to shift into the new technology. And the same will happen with electric cars, and in many ways for same reasons. We just need to encourage the people to try out the new technology. And Minnesota plug-in vehicle owners are very supportive of efforts to provide real-life information about electric vehicles to people and incentivize the shift to driving electric. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kukkonen. Next, Ms. Backus, did I get that right?
Yes, you did, Mr. Chairman. My name is Amber Backus. I'm with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association here on behalf of its 367 franchise new car and truck dealers in the state. And we want to thank Senator Marty for bringing forward Senate File 1948 and its approach of incentivizing consumers to purchase electric vehicles. This is still an emerging market, as EVs comprise only 0.2% of all the vehicles registered in the state of Minnesota. The two primary barriers to ownership are range and price, with EVs costing on average $10,000 to $15,000 more than the comparable conventional vehicle. States that have provided incentives to purchase EVs along the lines of what's included in Senate File 1948 have seen sales of 2 to 4 times the national average. And why would we want to incent the purchase of these EVs? As you heard from Mr. Hunter's testimony on the natural gas bill, emissions from mobile sources have dropped significantly over the past 10 years, but gas and diesel vehicles are the biggest source of pollutants like NOx and VOC that contribute to ground-level ozone. Encouraging Minnesotans to drive almost zero or zero-emission electric vehicles will further curb pollutants to keep Minnesota from becoming a non-attainment area, a consequence that could cost consumers and businesses hundreds of millions of dollars more than the incentives provided in this bill. And for the first time since electric vehicles came on the market, Minnesota saw a 10% drop in their purchase last year in 2014, which was somewhat surprising as the trends were for them to increase. So this becomes an opportune time to institute an electric vehicle rebate program. And as Mr. Jordan said, there are still some aspects of the bill that need to be worked out, but we hope you will vote to keep Senate File 1948 and the discussion moving. And thank you, and I'm happy to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Mr. Neeson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Nissen, Senior Policy Associate at Fresh Energy. And I just want to underscore the importance of having the electric industry fully supporting this bill. Fresh Energy thinks that electric companies are the critical missing link for widespread EV adoption in our state, whether that comes from infrastructure, incentives, communications and promotions, working with auto dealers, et cetera. So while we're fully committed to the plan that's proposed in this bill, we understand that some of the details might need to be worked out and that those details may differ from utility to utility. But that said, we think EVs are a win-win for everybody. As has been said, they can help utilities manage and shape load. They can help offset sales from distributed generation and efficiency. And they're up to 4 times as efficient to drive as their gasoline counterparts and can be up to 10 times cheaper to fuel. So benefit for drivers and benefits for society as we move towards a cleaner, more efficient transportation system. So encourage support for the bill and happy to answer any questions.
Oh, thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, again, the first section, the incentive the program for the utilities is, again, only limited to Minnesota Power and Xcel, but the rebates are available to anybody in the state, or any business or individual in the state.
Senator Marty, thank you. We have Senator Rosen and then Senator Osmick, and I didn't see anybody else with a finger. And then Senator Scalzi. So, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this may be really a stupid question, but how do you pay for your electricity? Do you put a credit card in? And I've never been around one of these. I have no idea how this works.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, at this stage, I've actually seen some places where they offer free plug-ins at certain places, but that won't last as more people move to this. But, again, most people who have electric plug-in cars have their own. They put in a 220 system in their garage or whatever and charge them at night, usually on a timer, so they kick in at the time. Because I think Dakota Electric we had testimony last year that they were charging, I think, 3 cents a kilowatt hour for off-peak. And if the House chair who bought one of these cars charged during the daytime, during peak hours, it might be 30 cents a kilowatt hour to charge. So the utilities are using it for balancing. But in terms of, Mr. Kukkonen could probably speak to how public stations are doing this.
Mr. Kukkonen.
Mr. Chair, members of committee. People normally charge their cars at home. So, for example, my wife, when she comes home from work, she just plugs it in and it charges overnight, and it's paid through our normal electric bill. So that's a normal setup. Then if you use the public charging stations, you normally have a prepaid card with you. Then you just swipe the card there, plug the car in, and it deducts the right amount from your account. That's the payment method.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, the cost of electric cars is not being spread all over the ratepayers, because I have seen some charging stations, one down by Union Station, actually, mm-hmm. in St. Paul here, that I just wondered if I have never really stopped to look. You put a card in that you've already, a prepaid card, basically. It's just not free electricity.
Mr. Kukkonen?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Madam Senator, no, it's not free electricity. You'll be paying for most of those stations. Some of the stations are free, but then the hosts have decided to make them free. For example, Lance and Bialys has some stations by their store, and they might be free because they want the people to come into the store to pay, I mean, do their purchases, because it's very cheap for them to provide free electricity for their customers there.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, I think there are some electric charging stations for state employees who park, and I think the judiciary ramp has some in there. They pay for the charging, but it is available. Mm-hmm. There are spots you'll often find that are reserved for vehicles that want to be charged. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, I mean, one manufacturer has cars at well over 200 miles range on one charge, and I think other companies are quickly gaining on it. There's a sheet in here that tells the average range, and ranges from some of them that are combination plug-in hybrid cars, which again requires you still to have the gasoline internal combustion engine, but those range from maybe 20 miles or so you can go. But I think a lot of cars are now, I've seen a number of them that are 60, 70 miles, and so people who are in a commute of 20 miles, 30 miles a day, it works. But for others, obviously, they're going to want it.
Senator
Rosen? Technology is changing every year, though.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen. Well,
and again, back to Senator Weber's comment about the loss of those taxes. That's something that we're going to have to deal with.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Marty, next one. Then
Mr. Chair, I agree that's going to, because we have to deal with the road stuff. And I expect as this becomes a growing segment of the market, that should be addressed soon. And I think Senator Dibble's committee is, I'm sure, going to be watching that.
Senator Rosen, follow up?
No, thank you.
Ms. Backus.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, happy to speak to that as well. As I said in my testimony, right now people who are making the choice to buy the environmentally friendlier electric vehicles are paying considerably more up front, which raises more in MVES, the motor vehicle sales tax, and the TAB fees. So right now, if you look at just a Ford Fusion, the electric versus the regular, the sales price difference is $29,000 versus $16,000. That's $2,200 in taxes on the electric versus $1,200 in the sedan, and the difference would equate to 7.5 years of fuel tax. So I think right now with the price differential, they're definitely paying more, but as it comes down and the price comes down and more people are buying them, it will be something to look at.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Senator Asmik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, wait until Senator Franzen's mileage-based user fee study comes in before we start celebrating that you're not going to be paying taxes. So be very careful where you go. Mr. Chair, this is Senator Marty. The heartburn I have here is Section 3. Because the way I'm reading this, and I ran it past council, is that on line 2.8 and 2.9, we're very clearly defining who's the target of the payer for the promotional program. And I understand why the auto dealers would be thrilled about this, is because we're going to be putting in a promotional program that promotes electric cars, and we're going to make the power companies pay for it, very specifically Excel, which is the ratepayers. Is Excel in the room? I'd like to have them come.
Mr. Pearson, you want to get in the batter's box here and see if we can throw you a softball or two?
Mr. Chair, not softball.
Okay, well, you're going to get a hard fastball thrown at you. We'll Mr. see. Pearson, welcome. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're going to develop a program. We don't necessarily know what the cost is. We're going to be going up onto the air probably with TV ads, radio ads, any number of promotional devices. And then later on in this, in that section, it says that you get to submit a plan, and then if the commission, PUC, doesn't like the plan, you get 75 days to do another plan. My question to Xcel Energy is, what's your thoughts on what this is going to cost? How much are we going to get from the ratepayers to pay for a program to promote electric cars?
Mr. Pearson.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Jim Pearson with Xcel Energy. Senator Osmick, you've got great questions. We have those same questions. I think the message I really want to share again with the committee is similar to the one that I think we talked a little bit with Senator Marty when we were talking about some of the other things. This is, we do not have consensus on this bill as we sit here today. We do, however, have a lot of shared goals and are looking for the opportunity to be able to kind of work on this as it goes through. We do not believe that we are the only ones who should be involved in the promotion of electric vehicles. We are concerned about some of the non-participant impacts. So all of the points you're raising are some of the conversations that we're having as an internal Drive Electric Minnesota group and with Senator Marty and others to try to kind of sort that out. You know, as we sit here today, we wish we had it all sorted out. We don't. But with that said, we understand sort of how things are moving through the process and are asking for some additional time to try to work those through.
Senator Marty.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, in the first section, approving the incentive plans, the commission, two of the three things listed are whether the plan is compatible with the interests of utility ratepayers and other interested parties and whether the plan conflicts with other provisions of the chapter. In other words, the Public Utilities Commission is always supposed to be looking at the good of all the ratepayers. So that's something they're supposed to be balancing. This is not meant to be a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign. We're hoping that they will do things to let their customers know and encourage people and let them know you have different time of day rates, that this can be a much less costly way to go in the future. I think the whole point of this is to give a jump start to this and help educate people about it.
Well, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Osmick.
Senator Marty, I guess the problem I have is that we're going, you know, I understand you're trying to talk about daytime rate, nighttime rates, where it's more efficient. I mean, that certainly can be part of a utility bill or a flyer inside of a utility bill. The problem I have is really the direction you're trying to go is to promote electric cars, which is going to be subsidized by a program to promote them by the electric company. I'm very uncomfortable with Section 3 that I think it's the cart before the horse, and it would be better to get a separate bill with this. If you're going to do this type of promotion, have a separate bill where the stakeholders are all together. I'd prefer if you took that out and came back with the promotion plan at a later date.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, as Mr. Pearson and I think all of the witnesses have said, is that we're still working on this. And we, again, the House author and I have talked briefly about this, but not that. This is scaled back significantly from the original bill as introduced, and we intend to be meeting with the stakeholders and trying to come up with better language. Because I think as it goes through the process, I want to have something where their people feel comfortable with this. And I'm going to ask the committee to keep it in now, but I will assure folks that I have not talked with Xcel or the utilities or these other folks about the details yet. They've been meeting with each other, and I will tell you that both I and the House chair, the House author, are planning to be meeting with them and working out details.
Thank you. No more questions, Senator Osmick, or you want to follow up?
No.
Senator Scalzi, and then Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rosen asked a good share of my question, but I was just wondering, in other places in the country or in the world where electric vehicles are used, are there any other ideas of contributing to the roads and bridges other than the gas tax and the proposed mileage recording system, which seems to be fairly unpopular? Are there any other choices that you're aware of?
Mr. Kukin is saying he's not aware of others. I'll say I'm not. Maybe somebody
Senator
else
Marty.
Is, but I'm sure people, I mean,
interesting.
I have a feeling that charging people who have a station in their garage for doing this, 220, I think, for any of those that have time of day rates, they have to have a separate meter for that. And if we were to try and do some way to compensate for fuel costs, something that way, there'd be plenty of options like that. But I think we're still at the early phases of this technology.
Senator Osmick, to that point.
Yes, to that point, Senator Scalzi, actually that was one of the things that came up during the debate in transportation on this, and I leaned over to Senator Franzen after the fact saying, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles knows exactly what you drive.
Right.
They will know exactly if you've got an electric vehicle, and they could certainly put a surcharge tax of $100 per year on you if they really want to. That would be far less invasive than actually putting a GPS on your car. So,
Senator Scalzi, any follow-up to Senator Marty? No. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If Mr. Pearson could come back. Actually, I was going to pursue the tax question that Senator Rosen brought up, and for the record, Senator Rosen, I think Senator Hoffman just intends to buy a lawn extension cord as far as the
I love it.
But as we look at the rebate here, Mr. Pearson, you know, $3,000. What is the expectation right now? And I understand, you know, there could be variable rates, da-da-da-da-da-da, but what is the expected amount of electricity that you would sell to an owner of an electric car in a year?
Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, that obviously varies on the make and model of the car and how much you drive in that. I think for general purposes, we have... we use a number about 300 to 325 kilowatt hours a month, so 3,800 kilowatt hours over a year, and I guess I'd
say that's a good number.
Okay, so that's a general planning number that we use. So it's it generally equates to a small residential customer.
Okay. So it will take
Senator
multiple.
Weber.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Sorry, it would take multiple years to recoup your $3,000.
Mr. Pearson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, yes. Now, the rebate dollars, I think part of the conversation we're having is we look at it is the infrastructure investment versus the rebate dollars. One of the concerns that we have with the language that's in front of us is there is language that talks about a utility rebate as well as the $3,000 rebate that's duplicative. We think that needs to be fixed before we carry this forward. My understanding of the conversations that we as a group have had is the $3,000 would be funded elsewhere. The utility rebate would be something that we would have to talk about. I'm not sure we'd want to be doing both. Certainly from an Xcel Energy standpoint, we wouldn't be advocating for both.
No.
Senator Weber, follow up?
No, I'm fine for now. Thank you.
So, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Osmick.
I just feel I have to do this just because I don't think this is ready for prime time. I would make a motion to delete Section 3.
Mr. Knopf, you want to go through delete what that means?
Want to delete sections 1, 2, and 3. I think they're all tied together.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we could probably remove sections 1 and 3. Section 2 just has the definition for electric vehicle, trying to tie it to this bill. I guess we, if to see if it go if it passes, then we can make an adjustment. 1 and 3.
Mr. Chair, I'd revise my motion to delete sections 1 and 3.
Senator Osmick has sections 1 and 3. Senator Marty, final word before I take
Mr.
a call.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the motion, and I would prefer, and again, I understand. I'm not trying to argue this is the language we want to pass into law. I think that we have just the coalition and the House and Senate authors are just beginning some conversations on this. They've been having a number of them, but I think as the authors have not had lengthy ones with them, and I think we can resolve this. I'm asking for a chance to do that by the time we get through to the Finance Committee. And again, this does have a fiscal note, so it will be there. And if the committee chooses to, yes, but I would ask you to keep it in for now.
Senator Osmick has a motion at the table to delete sections 1 and 3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. No. Noes have it. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to stand for more questions. Again, I wish the bill was more further along in process. I think we will be doing so, or I can pretty much assure you it won't go forward unless we have a bill that we're all confident makes good sense.
Thank you, Senator Marty. It's interesting this morning as I was with some energy folks from Xcel, and the conversation from some of the people were about the tax incentives that different states have regarding electric vehicles. And it was just so happens that here we go, and I was going to ask about that, but I'm not. So I had somebody – did you have anything
yes.
to say?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members and Senator Marty. I have an oral amendment to make a technical correction in the appropriation section. On lines 4.1 and 4.2, because I was making some changes very quickly to this amendment, it should say instead of Section 3, it should be Section 4 in both places on lines 4.1 and 4.2.
Oh. Senator Marty?
I'll move the change 3 to 4 in both of those two lines.
All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you. Senator Marty?
And, Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a commitment that before we hear it in Finance, before we ask for hearing in Finance, that we've had some of our meetings to work things out.
Yes, thank you, Senator Marty. Senator Marty moves as amended Senate File 1948 to pass and recommended to go to Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Senator Marty, congratulations. I think that's it.
Mr. Chair, we are reconvening tomorrow at 1:30.
1:30, we'll be here. Here?
107.
107.